There are some issues that I preach about or write about that are really questions that someone else has asked. And they've said, you know, why don't you address this particular issue? And so I do. But there are also questions that I'll confess to you I avoid because they're too tough. They're questions that I really don't have the answer to or don't know quite how to find those answers. And then there are some questions that I tackle simply because they're my question, because I really want to know, because it's something that I struggle with. And tonight's question is my question, even if it's nobody else's question. I want to know for myself, for understanding God and people and the world in which I live and reality. I want to understand, or at least try to, why some very good Christians end up in some very bad marriages. Now, I think I'm old enough to have seen a lot of life's problems and life's pains, and I'm sensitive enough to let it bother me. But I've got to tell you that of all the things, I think among those that bother me the most are seeing other Christians in painful, difficult, problem-ridden marriages. I think that Charlene can tell you about times, maybe too many times, when I have had difficulty getting to sleep at night, and that's not usually characteristic of me, simply because that day or recently, I've come aware of the pains in the relationships of a Christian couple. And there have been times I think I've been accused of an unwillingness to admit that people's marriages are over, it's done, it's time to go on. Sort of an unwillingness to give up, even though the evidence may say that there's time to give up. And I've tried to understand that. I think about myself. I've watched some other people's marriages. I've watched some very good friends who we went to college with, who have gone through some disastrous marriages. I've looked at some of the people that I've known that I've performed wedding ceremonies for over the last 25 years, people that I got to know very well, whose families I knew well, people whom I've counseled and worked through the premarital process and been friends, and have seen unexpectedly that their marriages have not gone well. And I've seen in my own extended family two of our family's marriages end in divorce this year in 1991. And I think that in each of these cases, there have been people that have claimed to be Christians. I mean, I believe them to be Christians. All of the evidence, at least for me, points that way. And as best I can tell, if I look at these people and look at their relationships, they're good people. They're people that I like, that I feel comfortable with, that I have a great deal in common with. People who started out with high hopes, just great expectations, with dreams of happiness, that everything was going to be ideal. They expected all this enormous happiness. And one day they discovered that instead, they had great pain that they never anticipated. And I keep asking, why? Why is that? How did that happen? For the reasons that I have gathered, I don't pretend to say are a complete list. I'm sure that there are many others that could be put on a list because I think that there is a secret mystery to every marital relationship, one that those outside never completely understand. Maybe even those that are involved in that relationship never completely understand because they're very complex. Very complicated. But this list, at least, is a beginning to understand at least some of the reasons why some very good Christians end up with some very bad marriages. I start the list with what I have called society's pressures. And I'd like you to look at another chapter of history in a place in the Bible, in Ezra, that little Old Testament book that we don't often read, chapter 9. It's page 746 in the Pew Bible. And I want to read to you just four verses and then comment a little bit about them. after these things had been done, the leaders came to me, this is Ezra speaking, and said, the people of Israel, including the priests and the Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons and have mingled the holy race with the peoples around them. And the leaders and officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. Then Ezra said, when I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. Then everyone who trembled at the words of the God of Israel gathered around me because of this unfaithfulness of the exiles. And I sat there appalled until the evening sacrifice. The problem in Ezra's day was that Hebrews had intermarried with heathen, and that was forbidden. And throughout the history of Israel, whenever this happened, it seemed almost always to bring heathen practices into the religion and the faith of the Hebrew people. But it wasn't always a problem. For example, if you know the history of the nation of Israel, you know that for hundreds of years they were in captivity in Egypt. And it wasn't a big problem then, this intermarriage, because frankly they didn't get along very well with the Egyptians, and the Egyptians thought that they were terrible, wouldn't have much to do with them. So hardly would they intermarry with them. Or after that was over, for 40 years, they sort of wandered around the desert peninsula of Sinai. And intermarriage wasn't a problem then either, because in those years, for an entire generation, there really wasn't anybody to intermarry with. And so, again, there was no problem. But during this chapter of Israel's history, they spent a couple of generations, about 70 years, in another imprisonment. It's called the Babylonian captivity because they were carried away by the Babylonians into their land and into opportunities, in fact, pressures to intermarry. So what was forbidden by cultural pressure became acceptable until everybody was doing it. The leaders were doing it, and they gave permission to everyone else to do it. And so the pressures of the culture affected the marriages of the people of God. Well, I compare that to what has been the case in the American society and culture throughout most of our history, when there has been largely societal pressure to keep marriages together. And that's been characteristic of our country. In fact, in many states, in the memories of many of us, it was against the law to end a marriage. In the state of New York, it was illegal until fairly recent times to have a divorce unless there was adultery and that adultery could be proven. But more important, we have moved into a very mobile society where a lot of the systems that pressured marriages to stay together have crumbled. They've fallen apart. The community pressures and the family pressures and the church pressures that encouraged marital stability have, in many cases, disappeared. In the 1970s, the divorce rate, the coming apart of marriages in America, just skyrocketed. I mean, unlike anything our nation had ever seen before. And there were some interesting comparisons that were made by those who take the polls to the evangelical Christian community. For while the divorce rate was very high in the population in general, it was comparatively low among evangelicals and in evangelical Christian churches. But that which we celebrated, we discovered, was not a cause of celebration by the end of the 1980s, when the divorce rates among evangelicals climbed up and, in many cases, matched that which was occurring in the rest of society. So society's standards and way of doing things has influenced the Christian community and the way we do things. And the societal pressures have been enormous. Things have changed. They've changed a great deal. I think back over my own experience as a pastor, and early in my pastoral experience, when I would talk to couples whose marriages were coming apart or where one person had walked away from the marriage, almost always, not quite, but almost always, it was a man who had left the relationship. Whereas I would say in more recent years, it has almost completely switched around, where it is far more likely that it is a woman who has left the relationship. Where society has changed, it has impacted us as Christians as well. Now, I want to say something here. I'm not suggesting that because people stayed together in marriages, their marriages were good. Because probably all of us know stories, maybe personal acquaintances, where people, because the laws wouldn't allow them to break up, stayed together but were very unhappy, and the marriage could be described as anything but good. And that occurs in many places even today. For example, in 1989, I was at a conference that was in the Philippines and was staying in a hotel. I think it was a Ramada Inn in the city of Manila. And I was there alone in one of those rooms where there is a door that is adjoining another room, and I could hear all the conversations that were going on. Now, there was one point in my jet lag experience when that was very irritating, and there was another point in which it was kind of entertaining because I couldn't go to sleep. And the people who were in the next room, I discovered, is this eavesdropping? I don't know. Anyway, give me the benefit of the doubt. It was a couple, a married man and his mistress. And I never saw them, but I felt I got to know them over a couple of days of listening. And one night, she said to him, I want us to get married. I want us to get married and to have children, and she had this big speech. And he said, well, you know, I can't do that. And she said, why not? And he said, well, because I'm already married. And, I mean, apparently they've been together, you know, for some time. I'm sure she knew that. And because I already have children. And I started asking some people, and I discovered, at least if my understanding is correct, that divorce in the Philippines is illegal. I mean, there is no legal divorce. So he was staying together in a marriage that obviously was defective. I mean, obviously had things wrong with it. That here he had a mistress, that he was in a downtown Manila hotel, but he was married. Well, just because people stay together does not mean that a marriage is good. But we do clearly understand that the influences of society and society's changing roles and pressures impact the marriages that we are in. And that is the point that I make. That society tolerates and even encourages our society here, now, infidelity, independence. I mean, not that there's a great deal wrong with independence in itself, but an independence that really is insensitive to the dependency relationships that are healthy within a marriage. That today's pressures in society are placing awful financial and time demands and relationship burdens on marriages. And it's causing cracks, deep cracks, so that some very good Christians are having marriages being pushed into difficulty because of the pressures of society and the astonishing changes that are taking place. But let me add that Christians have been under pressure at other points in history as well. Maybe no time greater than the days in which the New Testament was written and the time of the early centuries of the Roman Empire and the Christian church. The pressures were astonishing there as well. And it is precisely because Christians reacted against and had marriages of quality in the midst of atrocious immorality and huge pressures that Christianity was able to take over an empire when paganism failed. But no doubt, one of the main reasons is society's pressures. A second reason why some very good Christians end up in some very bad marriages has to do with unrealistic expectations. I was reading recently the book of Genesis and reading about some of their marriages there. Genesis 16 tells some very intimate details about the marriage of two very good people, Abraham and Sarah. They're lifted up as some of the giants of the ancient faith. Sarah had a very specific and high expectation for their marriage. It was that they would have children, and that they would have children quickly. But she didn't become pregnant. And as often happens when there are expectations in any relationship that are not fulfilled, she was deeply, deeply disappointed. So she concocted a plan where she would take a servant woman of hers named Hagar and give her, Hagar, to Abraham, her husband, so that he would sleep with her, have sex with her, impregnate her, and that way she would sort of second-handedly get a baby. Now, you read the story in Genesis 16, and you find this plan in verse 1. Abraham slept with Hagar in verse 3. Hagar became pregnant in verse 4. And Sarah is blazing mad at Abraham in verse 5 and blamed everything on him. I read this story. I read it in thinking about all of this for tonight. I read it again and again. And I thought to myself, how can two grown people who are godly people, Abraham is listed as the example of faith, number one. How can those people be so naive? How could they have been so stupid? But they were. They were completely unrealistic about their relationship. So being a person of faith, being a good person, being a godly person, does not protect us from unrealistic expectations. And I think that there are many of us, many couples, who have unrealistic expectations about marriage, who think that being in love is enough, that everything will work out fine, that all problems will be solved by themselves, that you can take some risky ventures, like pouring all of one's resources and energy into a career, or perhaps into two careers, and not working on the marriage relationship, of going one's separate ways and thinking that somehow the marriage will not be impacted by that, or that there will not be negative consequences. All these unrealistic expectations. And when those expectations are not met, the marriages are then judged to be bad. It's a rotten marriage because the expectations did not come true. Increasingly, and you know, it's hard not to sound negative and to beat this drum, but increasingly, as Christians, we need to recognize that life is hard. That life, in all of its dimensions, has its difficulties. That problems abound and that marriages face enormous challenges. That in the Christian life, there is pain as well as pleasure. And that hard work is required. And it is only when we as Christians accept the Bible's teaching that life is not easy and that the problems of life are real, that we will then have the greatest opportunities to live for Jesus Christ, whether things are good or whether things are bad. And only then will we have realistic expectations and will we learn, I think, the hard lesson to learn, the lesson that the difficulties can be our greatest opportunities to live for Jesus Christ and to strengthen our marriage relationships together. A third reason why some good Christians end up in bad marriages is what one author and psychologist has called drifting. Dr. Donald Harvey is a Christian counselor in Nashville. He's written a book that is called The Drifting Marriage, and I think that it describes many bad marriages between some good Christian people. I want to read to you just a few paragraphs out of a page that I copied out of Dr. Harvey's book. He says that drifting is one of the most common forms of marital failure. In fact, I would venture to say that the majority, I'm not sure if I go with his percentage, but he says a majority of those couples found in our churches from Sunday to Sunday have marriages which are adrift. Just think about that for a moment. Look across the pews. Who would guess that a majority of your friends have marriages that are in trouble? Would you? Probably not. And neither would they. Drifting. Not only is it the most common form of marital failure, it is also the most dangerous. It is subtle. It is quiet. It is non-offensive. It sounds no alarms. It just gradually creeps into our lives, and then it destroys. Step by step, the emotional deadness sneaks up on us as we move further and further away from our mates. The appearance of all is well is our placard. We fail to see the absence of real caring. Why should we see it? We have our preoccupations to keep us busy. The absence of emotional pain is accepted as a sign that everything is okay. We're busy. We're content, and everything is fine. We've grown accustomed to the way things are. He writes on that it was with Adam in the garden thousands of years ago, or as it was with Adam in the garden thousands of years ago, Christians today are seldom troubled with the problems that are obvious. Whether it be our personal life or our marital relationship, seldom is it the blatant, the obvious, the visibly immoral which presents us with the most difficulty. Wrangling, viciousness, open combativeness, these are not the characteristics of the failing Christian marriage. We have a far more subtle form of failure. We drift. He says, I'm reminded of Paul's observation in 1 Timothy 5:24 that while there are people whose offenses are so obvious that they run before them into court, there are others whose offenses have not yet overtaken them. And then he adds, I'm afraid that for many Christian marriages whose offenses have not yet overtaken them, it is only a matter of time. Well, I don't know, maybe drifting is just another way of saying society's pressures or another way of saying unrealistic expectations. It's the couple who go to their separate jobs, who are entertained in their separate ways, maybe have their separate friends, who don't work much on communication, who stretch the limits of intimacy until intimacy is lessened rather than increased, who maybe get hung up on possessions, who are driven by some set of priorities, until one day you look across the king-size bed and say, I'm not sure I really know that person. I'm not really sure that I love him or her. I'm not even sure that I like that person. So that the marriage that once was good, the marriage that once had such terrific promise, has turned rotten. It's maybe sort of like getting a new car and you're all excited about it and you're going to take care of it, but you got busy and it got you where you wanted to go, and so you never changed the oil, and there were some warning sounds, some squeaks and creaks and some strange noises, but you just kept driving it and driving it until one day it just quit. One morning it just doesn't start. Drifting. A fourth reason why some good Christians end with bad marriages is the assault of sin and of Satan. Of all the disciples of Jesus, I think it was only Peter who really had aspects of his marital relationship cross the path of what Jesus taught and the miracles that Jesus did. For it was Peter's mother-in-law, his wife's mother, who became ill and whom Jesus healed. I think that's interesting in view of all that Peter writes, for because of that we know of his marriage, that he writes in his little epistle or letter, the first of them in chapter 3, when he talks about a husband and a wife and what are the roles of each and how they should treat one another, he has some brilliant insights that, while I'm sure were inspired by the Holy Spirit, also I'm sure were written in his own experience. For example, in 1 Peter 3:7, he says that when a husband doesn't treat his wife correctly, when he doesn't treat her compassionately and with consideration and respect, God doesn't hear his prayers. I mean, there had to have been a day when Peter got down on his knees and there was something he really needed to pray to God about, and you just sensed that the heavens were made of brass. They got nowhere. And the light came on. He realized that God was not answering his prayers because he was not treating his wife as he should. And so he got off his knees and he made things right with his wife, and then he went back and prayed. And he discovered something that he just had to share with others in future generations. It was out of that relationship and that insight. So maybe it was out of that relationship and that insight, and his understanding of what was happening in his world and ours, that Peter added, just really a page or so later in 1 Peter 5:8, that you have an enemy. Your enemy is the devil, who prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. I think that there are a few places that Satan particularly picks as particularly appropriate to his agenda to victimize Christians, to destroy Christian faith and example. And in that short list, marriage has to be one of them. We can safely assume that Satan wants us to have bad marriages because he knows that a strong Christian marriage, especially when it makes it through the tumultuous chapters of life, is a powerful testimony to God. But we also know from our own experience, not Peter's, that we don't need Satan's help, that simply the invasion of sin can cause havoc on the stability and the strength of a marriage. Charlene and I had some very good friends that we met in college. I really got acquainted with them very well. They were married after we were, but we tracked with them for a while. They became missionaries. Missionaries that had, I think, a significant ministry. Until he chose a path of promiscuous homosexual sin. It was a sad story. I mean, a painful one. For it was later discovered that he was, each night, having multiple homosexual affairs with the people, the very men, that the team of missionaries was seeking to win to Christ during the daylight hours. You can only imagine what that did to her and to the other missionaries on that team and to the witness of Jesus Christ. She was and is a godly woman. And if I correctly understand it, and I think in this case I do, she did everything that she could. I'll tell you, she did more than I think I ever could do to make that marriage succeed. But his sin gave Satan a gigantic victory. We're reluctant to call things sin anymore. We're reluctant to say much about Satan. We prefer, hey, I prefer, to give everything a scientific name, a psychological explanation. And I think many times that's appropriate. But the truth of it is that sin and Satan destroy marriages, and that often, too often, innocent, godly partners are deeply wounded in the process. This past week, I was rereading the book of Job. It's a fascinating piece of biblical literature. And I was impressed again that Job was a man who I think went far, far more in the direction of doing right than I ever think that I could. I'm impressed with a man who did everything right and who suffered enormously because of Satan and because of the sins of others. And so I'm convinced, not just in the area of marriage, but in many areas of life, but in marriage especially, that there are some very bad marriages because of the sin of one or perhaps both partners. A fifth reason that I would add to an admittedly incomplete list is the lack of intimacy. Please understand that intimacy is something much more than sex. It is sharing one's emotions. It's sharing fears and hopes as well as bodies. It's mutual trust. It's respect. I think maybe the best way to describe it is that it's connectedness, a deep connectedness of two people together. I sat at the dinner table late last spring with a psychologist who has worked a lot, researched a lot, and written about extramarital affairs and why they happen. And as I was engaged in conversation with him, I don't know if he gave me new information or he helped me understand from his far better ability to explain it than I could some of the dynamics of what happens. He said to me that sexual infidelity in a marriage relationship is really secondary to the breach of intimacy. He said that when there is an adulterous affair, that trust has been broken, that intimacy has been shattered, and that it is a very difficult thing to rebuild trust and intimacy. Not that he doesn't think that it can happen. He's given his life to helping people rebuild it, but he says that it takes years. He says that in most cases, adultery is really
the expression or the result of failed intimacy, that it is an effort by people to connect, to connect with somebody else, because that deep connectedness is not there at home and in the marriage. You see, we all have a need for intimacy. But a lot of us have a lot of fears about intimacy because we're scared. And especially those that have been battered and bruised through childhood or through some other experience of life are very slow to enter into a deep, intimate relationship because there's the fear of being hurt again, an understandable fear. There's the concern that there'll be perhaps yet another betrayal. And so it takes a long time. It's built not in huge strides, but a millimeter at a time, just a tiny little bit. And it's constructed over this experience and that event until when it's there. And sometimes it's a fragile thing. When intimacy is there and it's that deep connectedness, it is in that relationship that you can truly be yourself with all of the walls taken down and all of the guard dropped. It's there that you can laugh and tell a joke and be understood, or you can cry. You'll still be accepted and loved. You won't be rejected. It's a wonderful thing. But intimacy takes two. You can't do that alone. You can't build intimacy with someone unless that other person wants to be intimate with you. And godly Christians may be married to others who shut them out, sometimes because they want to shut others out, sometimes because maybe of their own history and their own hurt. They're frightened to let others in. But where intimacy is absent, marriages tend to turn bad. One of the most powerful ways of deep intimacy is through mutual spirituality. I was fascinated to read a study that was done by Christian colleges about couples on the campus who were dating, praying together, and it had a kind of a strange conclusion. And that is that they shouldn't encourage dating couples on a Christian college campus to pray together, because statistically they discovered that it increased the likeliness of their being sexual with one another. And you might think, hey, if people pray together, they're going to be chaste. But the fact is that if they pray together a lot, they were more likely to have a sexual relationship. And that surprising result required some further study. And the conclusion of that particular study was that when people pray together, that there is a bonding and an intimacy that draws them together in ways that hardly, probably nothing else provides. I mean, there is something extraordinary and indescribable about praying together with someone else, holding hands, sharing your soul to God, confessing your sin, telling about your fears, asking in faith for God to do something special out loud that somebody else can hear. And this study concluded that when you share that depth of relationship, that it connects you in a way that calls for a further expression of connectedness, which is a sexual relationship. Now, I'm convinced that the couple which sincerely and continuously prays together in that way is not likely to grow apart spiritually, but is far more likely to share that deep connectedness, that intimacy that bonds their relationship together in an indescribable way. And that depth of sharing tends to permeate all of the rest of the relationship, including the sexual relationship, and that is a marriage that is far less likely to be broken. Sixth, and quickly the last on our partial list of why good Christians may have bad marriages, is what I've collected together in what I would call individual problems. It's based on the recognition that we all bring personal baggage into any relationship, and that sometimes that baggage is very heavy and hidden. For example, there are those Christians who enter into marriage sometimes unaware of the sexual abuse of their childhood, and they're as stunned as anyone else when the ramifications become apparent and the memories are resurrected. And sometimes they become like bombs that explode and hurt, sometimes without warning, sometimes with powerful devastation. Sometimes, not because people are to be condemned for it, but there's an inability or maybe an unwillingness to address those problems. Other times, those problems are addressed, but it's in a way that just shuts out the spouse. And it is if life somehow, in terms of those problems, the problems and the issues become central instead of the relationship. So that walls are built. Intimacy, if it was there, is lost. And an otherwise good marriage turns bad. But I've got to believe that few, if any, problems are unsolvable. We've got to believe in Christian faith that God has the extraordinary power and the desire to take those problems and to use them in a positive way to make even a struggling marriage better and good and strong. The difficulty is that individual problems crop up in marriages that are sometimes already struggling with those societal pressures. Marriages that already are not connected to some support system to help them through the crisis that they face. Marriages that may have unrealistic expectations that there will be no problems or distresses in them. Marriages that have a lack of intimacy, or marriages that are just woven with all of these things and the personal problems as well. Well, how do you conclude such a discouraging list of reasons? Well, let me throw some possible conclusions your way. One, that other Christians have faced the same reasons, and they have still had very good and successful marriages. I often think of a couple that Charlene and I also were good friends with, that we dated with before any of us were married. They married a year before us. They actually dropped out of school to get married. And then in the ensuing years, our paths separated, and they moved a long ways away, and we lost contact. Until a couple of years ago, for reasons I've forgotten, he wrote to me, and we renewed our relationship through the mail and through a series of letters. He told to me what was an astonishing story. That Dave and Mary had awful difficulties in their marriage, and it was really bad. So they went to a marriage counselor where they lived, and that marriage counselor put them through a series of tests, met with them together and met with them individually, and then brought them in to present, I think reluctantly and kindly, his conclusion. His conclusion was that they never should have gotten married in the first place, that they were terribly mismatched. And that there was, I think he indicated he had never said this to any other couple in all of his counseling, that there was no hope for their relationship. And he said to them, as painful as it is for me to say it, I think that the right answer is that you get a divorce as soon as possible. They went home and they talked about it. I think they prayed. And they decided a few days later to go back, and they had a proposal for that marriage counselor. They said to him, would you be willing to work with us and let's give it a try? He reiterated his warning and said, I don't think it's going to work. But if you're willing to try and spend the money, then I'm willing to try as well. And so they did. Dave's letter described a lengthy course of years. And then he explained in his letter that the result of it all was that now their marriage is wonderfully good, but that's not the point that I make. The point that I make, and most memorable to his correspondence, was he said that he and Mary have become highly intolerant of couples who give up too easily on their marriages. So I conclude that other Christians have faced these same reasons, and they've still ended up with good and successful marriages. A second conclusion is that you can do everything right and still have things turn out wrong. I'll give you a good example. God. God put perfect people in a perfect garden on a perfect earth, and it turned out rotten. God chose a nation of Hebrew people, called them his own, loved them with all his heart, gave them his law and gave them his grace. He called them his spouse. He said it was like he was married to Israel. He was absolutely faithful. God did nothing wrong at all. And the conclusion of it was in Jeremiah 3:8, God said, I'm a divorcee. He ended up in a divorce with the Hebrew people whom he loved. And so there are godly Christian men and women who have done everything right. Oh, not perfect like God, but maybe pretty close, pretty close. And their marriages have turned out wrong because of the choice of others. And that is one of the harsh realities of living in a sin-infested world where people may choose to do right or wrong, and our right does not necessarily forbid others to do wrong. A third conclusion, and in a moment we conclude, is that when one person's heart hardens, it may be impossible to make that marriage good. When Jesus talked with people in his day about the problems of marital breakup and distress, he said in Matthew 19:8 that Moses allowed for divorces. It's told the story of it in Deuteronomy 24. And that he did it, Jesus said, because of the hardness of their hearts. I think that's true today as well. That there are many marriages that are bad, not because they have to be bad, but because one or two people have hardened their hearts against God and against what God wants to do. I met a man this past week from out of town. This had nothing to do with why I was meeting with him, or I don't really know why he told me this. It's sort of, he told me and then went on with the rest of his story. In the middle of the conversation, it kind of took me back because it was rather unrelated, said that he and his wife had an awful marriage and they ended up in divorce. Then he said, we both turned to Jesus Christ and we're married again and have a wonderful marriage. Why? You see, apparently in their cases, hardened hearts were softened. But I'm saddened to say that that is most often not the way it is. That a lot of hard hearts stay hard. And even if one's heart is soft towards God and towards God's solution, the other person's heart may be as hard as a rock.